turn once again to the Parsha of Shelach, which is not exclusively about the Meraglim, but certainly dominated by the Meraglim. And let us see who they were. In the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel, we're told each Shevet sends a representative, and they are none other, as the end of Pasuk Beis tells us, Kol Nasibahem, the Nasiim themselves. Okay. There are a dozen Psukim, starting from Pasuk Dalet until Tet Zayin, which are dedicated to telling us exactly who they are, to giving us their names. Now, okay, that's very nice. So let's read. Ve'ele Shemosa, Lamate Reuven, we begin with Reuven. Who is the Nasi of Reuven? Shamua ben Zakur. Lamate Shimon, Shafat ben Chori. Now, without reading all 12 psukim, we may begin to notice, if we're paying attention, that none of these names are familiar. We know Kalev and we know Yehoshua, but not as the Nasiim. Now, it happens to be, for our enlightenment, the Torah has actually made reference to the Nasiim by name every single parsha since the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. So, we know who they are. Lemate Reuven, Elitzur ben Shideur. So you go through each one. And it's a little bit disconcerting because we're looking, we finally got familiarized with the names of the Nasiim and we don't recognize any of the Nasiim here. Shamua ben Zakur, never heard of him. Shafat ben Chori. And that's a very simple question. Where did these Nasiim come from? What happened to the other Nasiim? Interestingly, the Rashbam comments, I don't think that he makes mention of this question, but if we see his comment, the question will fall away through his translation of the word Kol Nasibahem, because that's how it started. The Pasuk told us these are, each one it's Nasi, these are not the Nasiim as we are familiar with them. How to reconcile? Well, says the Rashbam, grandson of Rashi, Iker pshuto kach, the primary pshat of these words, kol nasibahem, is, Eile shneim asar anoshim tikach, take these 12 people, may osam shebi Yisrael, from those amongst Yisrael, she nasa osam libam loleches. Nasa osam libam. That is an expression that may be familiar to us. We've encountered it when there were donations to the Mishkan. Kol asher nisa'o libo, everyone whose heart raised them up. It's a person who volunteers to do something, who tries to rise to the occasion, from the word nisa, ram vinisa. The Rashbam understands that the pshat of the expression kol nasibahem does not mean a prince. It doesn't mean nasi like we would use the English word nasi, meaning the chief. It is a pure derivation from the word nisa, which means raised up, anyone who wishes to rise to the occasion. Kol nasibahem. So that's very interesting, because once we translate the word nasi in this way, as we mentioned, we no longer have a problem, because actually the Torah never said that these 12 were the Nasiim. They were kol nasibahem, not the princes, but people who had volunteered, and these are the names of the 12 volunteers. So that's lefi ikur pshuto, according to the Rashbam. It's a very interesting peirush, because he takes the word nasi and takes it out of the standard understanding as we would have it. That's the Rashbam. Interestingly, another of the Rishonim, the Chizkuni, who's also often works very much al derech hapshat, the Chizkuni understands, it seems, that nasi means nasi, and it means the princes, But in response to our question, well, these are not the princes of the tribes as we know them, the Chizkuni makes a different comment. If we have a look at the beginning of Pasuk Beis, Shalach Lecha Anashim, so who is told to send the spies? Moshe. Shalach Lecha. Let's keep going. V'yasuru es Eretz Kanan, asher anino sein levnei Yisrael, ish echad lemateh avosav, tishlochu. That's interesting, because the sending through the run of the Pasuk has expanded from the singular. We've gone from Shlach Lecha to Tishlochu. Tishlochu is the plural, except there's only one of Moshe Rabbeinu. Who then are the subjects of Tishlochu? Who is doing the sending? Says the Mizrahi, that is why the Pasuk concludes and says, Kol Nasi Bahem. Each one is sent through his Nasi. The Nasiim are the senders, not the sent. Shlach Lecha begins with Moshe, but of course part of the representation of each tribe is that not only does each tribe have someone sent, but each tribe has its Nasi sending that individual.
The main Nasi of each tribe.
Yes, but the one who was sent, not the Nasi, he's sent by the Nasi. And who are the names of the people that were sent by the Nasi? The Ela Shemosam, these are other people, and these are their names. So it's very interesting just to look and read and translate the Pasuk, and already we see there are a number of possibilities. Now, that said, there is a third approach. And it begins by making reference to a very interesting, well, it's an interesting question, it becomes an interesting machlokas, with regards to put this very delicately, the way the Torah phrases things. And what that means is there is a concept which is held by some of the rabbis of the Talmud, Tanoim, in fact, which is called Dibra Torah Koloshim B'nei Adam. The Torah expresses itself like people, in the way of people. Now, of course, that has to be significantly qualified, but at the end of the day, as far as this approach is concerned, the Torah is written for B'nei Adam, and therefore, to a certain degree, it is written in the way of B'nei Adam. The more like B'nai Adam it is, the more they can relate to it, to a degree, of course. What would be an example, just to crystallize this instantly, what would be an example of Dibra Torah Kolosha B'nai Adam? Some say the Torah speaks like B'nai Adam, other opinions say the Torah doesn't speak like B'nai Adam. An example would be repetitions of words. For example, you find many parshas in the Torah begin with the words Ish Ish. Ish, ish, who will do this, ish, ish, who will do that. And the question is, the repetition of the word ish, is that the second time? Is that someone else? Is this referring to a different person? Or is it really the Torah's way of saying anyone? We would say anyone, the Torah says ish, ish. That's how you would say it in Lashon HaKodesh, and that's how the Torah speaks. And that's a machlokas, and there are halachic ramifications, because for those who understand lo dibra Torah kolosha b'nei Adam, the Torah does not waste words even in the interest of talking like people. If there's an extra word, an extra ish, it's going to include an extra person in that mitzvah or parsha or category or whatever it is. But if you say that dibra Torah kolosha b'nei Adam, there is no room for that halachic inclusion, and therefore there will be nafkiminis. There will be ramifications between that will come out from this machlokas. Now, a very interesting application of this machlokas is to be found in our parsha. Rabbi Yishmael is of the opinion Dibra Torah Kolosha B'nei Adam. As far as Rabbi Yishmael is concerned, the Torah can say a word again, and it's too either to emphasize or to establish. And when a word is repeated, says Rabbi Yishmael, Lishonos Kefulim. It's a doubled over expression. Lishonos Kefulim.
Doesn't have extra words.
True, but this, if it's Dibra Torah Kolosha B'nei Adam, it's not an extra word. Because in order to establish it as the way that people speak, if that's the value, that's not called extra. as far as Rabbi Akiva is concerned, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel often argue with each other. They argue on this point. Rabbi Akiva says, and there's another word, it's telling you something else. Lashonos ribuyim heim. It's coming to include something else. And the Yerushalmi in Masechah Sota, in the 7th Perek, brings an example from, once again, Bamidbar Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Beis. If you've never looked at the Pasuk in this way, it can be a little bit unsettling, but we'll see it through. Shlach lecha anoshim, send men, v'yosuru es eretz Kanaan, asher aninu sein lefnei Yisrael, let them spy out the land. Very nice. Well, how many go per tribe? Says the Pasuk. Ish echad, lemate avosav tishlachu. So how many go per tribe? The answer is ish echad, ish echad. Now the question is, what does that mean? And the answer is, we have now entered a machlokus, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel. As far as Rabbi Shmuel is concerned, ish echad is like ish ish, l'shonos kefulim. It means one per tribe, one for each and every tribe, giving you a total of 12. However, says the Yerushalmi, if we understand, like the approach of Rabbi Akiva, that Lashonos Ribuyim, then when the Pasuk says, ish echad, 1 plus 1 equals 2, and 2 times 12 equals 24. As far as Rabbi Akiva is concerned, there were 24 people in the delegation that went from the Bnei Yisrael to look at Eretz Yisrael. That's not a halachic machlokus, but I think it's very interesting. It changes the way that we look at many things. And of course, the first question that we need to ask, apart from becoming aware of this basic machlokus, is why, if we can ask. Why? As if to say, we understand it's reasonable that each tribe should be represented. That for us is not unreasonable. But how many does it take to represent? One can represent. Why two? Keep an eye on each other. Tarti lomali, as the Talmud often asks. Why do I need two? It's a very Jewish question. And moreover, there is a further problem. And this problem actually comes from the Torah itself. Because if we look in Parsha Shelach, it's open. Ish echad, does that mean two per tribe, which gives you 24, or one per tribe, which is 12? It's open. But the matter is settled later on, because in Sefer Devarim, in Perek Aleph, Pasuk, Kaf Gimel, Moshe Rabbeinu, as he's going over the episode, said, I took from all of you, one per tribe, 12 men, Shneim Asar Ish, and Shneim Asar Ish brooks no misunderstanding. Which is a very serious question with regards to the approach of Rabbi Akiva, as applied on his behalf by the Yerushalmi, because you can't say 24 if the Pasuk said 12. Okay. Now, let's keep going and catch up with the with the Meraglim in Pasuk Kaf Dalet. Or actually, if we start with Pasuk Kaf Gimel, there's a place which is, it's a very unusual place, because something happened here. Vayavou ad Nachal Eshkol. They come to a place called Nachal Eshkol. Vayichrisu misham Zemora ve'eshkol anovim echad. So they cut a cluster of grapes, vayisu ubamot bishnaim, and they carry it. Uminarimonim uminateinim. Pomegranates and figs. Okay, they take from the fruit of the land, which is what they were told to do. Ulekachtem mipri ha'aretz. Fine, so they do. Lamoka mahu kora nachal eshkol. That place was called Nachal Eshkol, alodos ha'eshkol, on account of the cluster of grapes, asher karsu misham b'nei Yisrael. Okay. So it's interesting, as renaming places go, it's an interesting name to choose. Because they came to a place called Nachal Eshkol, and they decided to rename it Nachal Eshkol. So it's economic, but Rashi actually says that when the Pasuk tells us that they came to Nachal Eshkol, it's Al Shem HaOsid. That means that the Torah is calling it Nachal Eshkol because that's how it's known by the time you're reading the story, this place is called Nachal Eshkol. But it was called Nachal Eshkol on account of the Eshkol that they took. There's a very interesting comment of the Vilna Gaon, actually, who notes that actually they did rename it. It was called Nachal Eshkol before they came, and they renamed it Nachal Eshkol, and still it's a different name. And the reason why is because the original reason why it was called Nachal Eshkol is because it belonged to the territory of Eshkol. Eshkol, as in one of the three allies of Avram Avinu, Oner, Eshkol, Umamre, and therefore it is Nachal Eshkol. They renamed it because it took on another meaning based on the Eshkol that they took. And should you say, well, it's exactly the same as it was before, there's one difference. And that is, if you look at the word Eshkol in the beginning of the Pasuk, it's written without a Vav, Eshkol. By the time the Pasuk ends, it says in the next Pasuk, Lamakomu kara nachal Eshkol with a Vav. That Malay spelling is because it's actually filled out in terms of reasons why it was called Nachal Eshkol. So, thus far in terms of the renaming. But I have a different question. And that is, I'm reading Pasuk Kaf Gimel and then Pasuk Kaf Dalet. They called it Nachal Eshkol on account of the Eshkol that they Asher Karsu Misham Bnei Yisrael. That word, or those two words, Bnei Yisrael, are completely redundant. Because for the whole time, we have been talking about Jews. And we never referred to them as Bnei Yisrael before, because it's from the minute they're sent from the Bnei Yisrael, they are Bnei Yisrael, and therefore everything they do is what the Bnei Yisrael does. It doesn't say, for example, in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Vayavou Bnei Yisrael at Nachal Eshkol, Vayichrusu Bnei Yisrael Misham. It doesn't need to say it, because we know who they are, and therefore to refer to them as Bnei Yisrael at the end seems to be redundant. That's the first wave of the question. It seems unnecessary to tell me that they were Jewish. If I don't know that by now, I should really go back to the beginning of the Parsha anyway. But secondly, and this is it's a further emanation of this question, they have been given an appellation prior to this. They have been given a title. From the moment they have left, they have been called Anoshim. We find Eile Shemos HaAnoshim, Shlach Lecho Anoshim in Pasuk Beis, Pasuk Tetzayin, Eile Shemos HaAnoshim. And that's who they are. They are the people, that's all. And therefore, if for some reason it is necessary to reiterate who we're talking about, they should be called what they've been called all along. They called the Nachal Eshkol on account of the cluster of grapes, Asher Karsu Misham, Ha'anashim. It's done us fine until now. But there's actually been a shift of terminology from Anoshim to Bnei Yisrael. And there is another question. And that is, I think, it's one of these things that we're so used to it that it doesn't occur to us to maybe question it. They took a cluster of grapes. Why? Because Moshe told them to. And they renamed the place. Why? No one knows. In other words, when do you rename a place? You rename a place to mark an event, to mark an occasion. That's not their job. Their job is not to start giving new names to all the places. They'll wait. Soon enough, it will be Yerushalayim and whatever you want to call it. But in the meanwhile, you don't need to already start town planning. And especially as the job of these men, ostensibly, is to keep a low profile. They can't start having name-giving ceremonies. I don't know if they broke a bottle of champagne, but even if they didn't, for whose benefit and exactly for whose edification have they changed the name to Nachal Eshkol? Even as name changes go, it's relatively mild. But the whole thing seems to be completely unnecessary. Okay. Now, let's go back to Pasuk Kaf. And these are the final instructions of Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Uma ha'aretz, what's the land like? Hashmeinohi Imraza, is it fertile land, barren perhaps? Hayeshba Itzim Ayin, does it have trees? Vehischazaktem ulekachtem mipri haaretz. And an interesting word that sometimes maybe goes untranslated as we would balpeh describe what Moshe said. He told them to check out the land and to take some of the fruit. But Moshe told them to do something else as well. He said, Vishazaktem. Now, what does Vishazaktem mean? Well, the simple understanding is, which is that actually the translation of Unculus, is strengthen yourselves. Okay. Why should you strengthen yourselves? Well, if you knew the size of the fruit, so you'd understand that they need to strengthen themselves before. But even so, where is there room for an extra formal instruction of Vishazaktem? However strong you need to be to carry, and that's how strong you need to be. This Sephorno has a very interesting explanation of the word Vishazaktem. And that is Lihios Muchzokimba, to be entrenched or holding in the land. That is to say, when we have the concept of a chazaka, which is interchangeable with the concept of achuza, because the two are the same. Achuza is a holding, an estate. One is ochez, one holds onto something. One is machzik, one holds onto something. Lios muchzokimah means, apparently, that part of what these people are meant to be doing when they go into Eretz Yisrael is not just to bring back information, but to already initiate the acquisition of the land of Israel on behalf of the Jewish people. Lios mochzakimba. One of the ways it is possible to acquire land is through chazaka. What is a classic example of chazaka? Take from the land. If you act as the owner, you're the muchzak. Vehischazaktem ulekachtem mipri haaretz takes on a different meaning now, because it is no longer purely strengthen yourselves and bring back fruit, but rather make a chazaka, and the way that you will accomplish that is by taking of the fruit, as the owner does. And indeed, this understanding of Vehischazaktem is also, I would say, echoed, but pre-echoed, because it's in the Targum Yonis in Ben Uziel, much before the Sforno. He translates the words Vehischazaktem as V'ta'avdun chezkosa, make a chazaka. That's support for the Sforno. It turns out, therefore, that this delegation is present in Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan, as is known then, in two different capacities. On the one hand, as a fact-finding mission, and on the other hand, as the first move in the acquisition of Eretz Canaan, to make a chazaka. And what's very interesting is, if we take a look at these people, how do we view them? Who are they? And who do they need to be in order to do what they have to do? The answer will vary depending on which aspect of their mission we're talking about. Because if we say that, if we're talking about the aspect of bringing back information, how many people do they need to be? They don't need to be more than who they are, naturally. There are 12 people, and each person is finding out what he needs to find out and relaying it back to his shevet. So in terms of the Yasuru aspect, they are anoshim, they're people. But when it comes to the chazaka aspect, when it comes to the kinyan that they are about to make for Eretz Yisrael, who is to end up having initiated their ownership of Eretz Yisrael? Those 12 people? No. The entire Jewish people. But only 12 people are doing it. But of course, in this respect, they are representatives, they are shlichim of the Jewish people. But when they take, not only do they, as 12 people, come to initiate their ownership, but everyone they represent. And that is why, I believe, as long as they have been journeying, looking, talking, they're called anoshim, because that's where they are. They don't need to be looked at as anything more than 12 individuals to say what they saw But there's one place where they're given a different name, because that's a place that they're functioning in a different capacity. And that is when they cut the grapes from Nachal Eshkol. Because at that point, that is v'hischazaptim. They're making a chazaka. They are requiring, on whose behalf? Not only their own, but on behalf of the entire Jewish people. And that is why the end of the pasuk refers to them not as Anoshim anymore, but as Bnei Yisrael. Because they represent the entire Bnei Yisrael in this act. Through the Lekachtem of Pri Haaretz, the entire Bnei Yisrael came one step closer to owning Eretz Yisrael. So that is that. Yes?
These grapes, these peonies, these remoraines, didn't somebody plant them? Isn't that the owner?
Yes.
They just took the fruit. They didn't make them the owner, the one who planted.
True. But in a sense, it's the first step of taking over Eretz Yisrael, where they'll ultimately come to own everything that people planted initially. So that's how it starts. That's what it means. Entering Eretz Canaan means, in a sense, living where other people used to live and owning things other people used to own.
You go to somebody's house, somebody's land, and you just take their fruit.
That's ultimately what happens. Well, it depends if the one who's able to bestow ownership agrees to it. In this instance, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, but it takes the form of an act of kinyan. If God hadn't sanctioned it, that would be stealing. If he does sanction it, it's called owning. Stage by stage. We haven't finished. We haven't finished. We haven't finished. Let's keep going. And let's ask an interesting question. Who is most fitting to do this job? Now, that's still an interesting question. The reason why it becomes even more interesting is because we now realize that there were two things to be done. There is the rigul, there is the reconnaissance, and there is the act of kinyan. Now, I think it's fair to say that when it comes to the act of kinyan, the person who is most fitting to perform that act on the part of the Shevet is the Nasi of the Shevet. He doesn't need any other qualifications. For every reason that made him the Nasi of the Shevet makes him able to represent the Shevet. That doesn't make him necessarily the person who is most qualified to find out what needs to be found out about Eretz Canaan. That has different requirements altogether. One does not go with the other. And it could be that it is for this reason that Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion here that actually it was two people that went from each Shevet, because there were two things to be done and each one was qualified to do a different job. When it comes to the act of Kinyan, that's called Nasi Bahem. But when it comes to the fact-finding, so then Nasi, not necessarily. On the contrary, there were 12 other people more qualified, each one in their own way. And what's interesting is, if we take a look again at Pasuk Beis. So let us see. Moshe is told, Shlach lecha anoshim. The first thing he's told is to send individuals, anoshim. What are the anoshim for? Well, v'yosur, as Eretz Canaan, asher ani nosein, livnei Yisrael. Their job is to spy out the land. But they're not the only ones going. Because it is ish echad l'mater v'sof tishlachu. It's two per person, because each one will be accompanied by kol nasi bohem. And that is why the only individuals that the Torah needs to tell us who they are the ones that we don't know who they are already. We know the Nasiim. But the anoshim, as the Pasuk Gimel says, kulam anoshim, they are introduced, ve'ele shemosa. And I believe, perhaps, with this in mind, we can approach once again the Pasuk in Devarim. Because the Pasuk in Devarim has Moshe Rabbeinu saying explicitly that, I took 12 of you. So 12 cannot become 24. So how can Rabbi Kiva say 24 went if Moshe said 12 went? But once we understand that it wasn't two people for the same reason, it was two people for two different reasons, then the goal of what Moshe is looking to bring up again is the regal aspect. It's not the Kenyan aspect. The Kenyan either worked or didn't work. Presumably it did. But it's specifically those that failed, or perhaps more than failed, malpracticed in their job to bring back the correct information that they were qualified to do. Out of the 24, there's only 12 that become isolated as far as what Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about. What's very interesting is, and I don't have a ready answer for this, so I offer it as a thought for consideration, it's interesting to ponder that actually there were thus another 12 people who must have had an opinion. They may not have had expertise about conquering the land, etc., but they were there, they saw what everyone else saw. And it's interesting that for Rabbi Akiva, we don't hear much for them. They weren't consulted. Their job is they're purely in a ritual capacity, it seems, or a formal capacity to make the kinyan. No one seems to consult with them. They're not canvassed either for or against in terms of the critical 12 meraglim. And that's interesting to consider how Rabbi Akiva views whether they could have said anything, whether they should have said anything. But we do see that these Nasiim do continue on to next week's Parshas Korach. They're still there. They meet their end in Parshas Korach, but that's already for next week. Now, I'd like to stay on Pasuk Beis, actually, because from Pasuk Beis and onwards, the question that we ask every year, hopefully looking for new insight each year, is what to make of the idea to send Meraglim. We're all Chachomim because we know how it turned out, but if we put ourselves from the outset, it was certainly ill-fated. But the question was it ill-conceived? In other words, it ended up badly, but was it doomed to end up badly? In a word, was it wrong to send Meraglim, which means it's a mistake from the start and the most you can hope for is a neutral outcome? Or maybe was it a good idea? Could it have been a good idea? It's interesting, just while we're talking about these names, we mentioned, spoke at length about the fact that we don't necessarily recognize them. They may not have been the Nasiim. But there's another interesting thing, because if we read again, Pasuk Dalet, Ve'ele Shmosam, Lematei Reuven, who comes first? Reuven. Very nice. Who's next? Shimon. So far, so good. And then Levi is not involved. At least no one was sent from Levi. And therefore we go to Yehuda. And that more or less is the end of any order that we could have predicted. Because what will happen from now is there is Yisachar, Ephraim, Binyamin, Zevulun, Yosef, Dan, Asher, Naphtali. I wonder if there is anyone who could, without looking in the psukim, recite the order of the Shvatim as they are mentioned in terms of being represented by their Shevet. This is no order that we have ever seen them before or ever will again. So how do we account for it? And Rishonim asks this question. Ramban talks about it. The Ramban says that, and perhaps if we understand that we're focusing more on the individuals than we are on the Shevet per se, the Ramban says that they are ordered here, Lefi Seder Ma'alosom, in accordance with their Mala, with their level. Now, how does one define level? Difficult to know. Easy for the Ramban to know, difficult for us to know. We should note that if they are defined as by their level, it turns out that Yehoshua made a great comeback because he is about halfway down the list. I would have imagined if you're talking about their Mila, Kalev and Yehoshua should be number one and number two, and then the last 10 places could be shared by whoever else. But numbers one and number two are people who end up in not a very good state at all. Kalev is number three, and Yeshua is number five. So, did something happen? Was there a drastic reversal? Or is there another way of measuring Mila that is entirely unrelated to merit? Difficult to know. Ramban, of course, is aware of all of these questions. But this is his approach to what to make of this unusual Seder. The Sephorno, also responding in his way, says there was a matter of age. Lefi hazikna, lefi hagil. How do we know exactly who was older than who? I don't know. One thing is for sure, however you configure it, you never saw it before, you'll never see it again. Now, in Chumash Devarim, once again, when Moshe, and this actually is the first episode, it's very interesting, because the first pasuk of Devarim is everything, in encoded, all of those places that are oblique references. But the first episode that is really opened up and discussed is the Meraglim, before the Chet HaEgel. It's interesting. And it begins. in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Vatikrevuna Lai Kulchem. That's where we find out that it was the idea of the Bnei Yisrael. There's no mention of that here in the beginning of Shelach. Vatikrevuna Lai Kulchem. Okay. Now we know. There's an amazing Rashi, actually, on Vatikrevuna Lai Kulchem. Because the word Kulchem is obviously emphasizing something. Vatikrevuna Lai is you came towards me. Kulchem, all of you. Rashi says, Be'erbuvya. You came all mixed up, all jumbled, tripping over each other. Not nice. In a non-orderly way. Didn't give respect to the Zakenim. When the criticism comes, it comes on everything. Not only on the national disaster of the Meraglim, which haunts the Jewish people from that point onwards, but on Derech Eretz also. Nothing is spared. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky discusses the question of the Meraglim. And the burning question of, could it have been a good idea? Essentially what it boils down to is the fusion or the meeting point between what we call bitachon, trust in God, and ishtadlus, making an effort in the way of the world. Now as we know, there must be room for the two to exist. Bitachon does not mean to have HaKadosh Baruch Hu do everything. And in fact, there is possibly even room for a misunderstanding here. In other words, one may take an approach towards bitachon that seems to be a very elevated approach. It may be a basic error. Because when we talk about the concept of hishtadlus and bitachon, what's hishtadlus? I have my job. What's bitachon? I trust in God. So the question is, where do you do what? There is a certain common notion that, look, I'm not going to do everything. I'll take care of some things. That's my hishtadlus. And the rest I'll leave up to God. That's my bitachon. In other words, the inner circle is the hishtadlus. That's my area of endeavor. And then there is a border. And on the other side of that border is God taking care of all the things that I didn't take care of. And never the twain shall meet. And that is possibly a grave error in terms of what bitachon is, because it actually ends up being certainly a vacuum of bitachon in terms of everything you're doing, because bitachon is only for the things that I don't do. So I only really rely on God to take care of the things that I'm not taking care of myself. We're a good team. But that means that there is actually no bitachon in terms of what you're doing. So who is responsible for all of the success from your job? That's me. That's mine. But I don't work on Shabbos, so then whatever happens, that God does that. But Sunday to Friday, that's me. So that's one has hollowed out, actually, God for most of the week. And left me talking for Shabbos, for example, or lunchtime. And what we see from the Mefarshim is that the opposite is true. In other words, the relationship between bitachon and ishtadlus is not exclusionary. That there's never any room for both at the same time. They are complementary, one to the other. Bitachon is to accompany every step of ishtadlus that a person makes. Because ultimately what ishtadlus is all about, and bitachon is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has seen to it that this is the way that I need to act in the world. I cannot be neglectful. Where does bitachon come in? None of this will make any difference if God does not bless it with success. That's bitachon. Ubeirachacha b'chol ma'asiyadecha she'ta'aseh. And this is something that we find from the very beginning. I don't wish to oversimplify in any way, but Yaakov Avinu, all of his encounters, as the way that the Chumash presents them, is always a combination of both. Just before he meets Esau, he prepares himself, and then he davens. And he didn't use his preparation as a means, of course, this is Yaakov, light years away from us, but to learn the lesson from him. He didn't use his preparation as a means to say, well, then davening is redundant because I've taken care of it. He didn't use his tefillah to say, well, I don't need to prepare anything because God will take care of it. But the two go together. That's bitachon and ishtadlus. And if that's true, it sounds like there is no reason why the move to send Meraglim to Eretz Yisrael should have been looked upon as a bad idea. It sounds like natural, healthy hishtadlus, because there's no reason why it should be a contradiction to your trust in God to give you the land. The two go hand in hand. That, in principle, is a good idea. The question is, where does it come out? Where did it go wrong? So, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, if I can paraphrase and borrow an expression, but it's really, it is the signature of his understanding of bitachon. Bitachon is not what you do, it's the way that you do it. In other words, if you have bitachon, it will change the way you go about things. If you know that ultimately someone else's control of the outcome of all of these things, it changes the way that you relate to these things. If you feel in the worst of ways, im ein ani li mili, that's it. If it's not me, no one else is going to take care of it. There is a certain feeling of desperation that can sometimes creep in because I can't rely on anyone other than myself. I can't pass up any opportunity. I can't leave anything to chance. And it gives a certain added level of anxiety that you wouldn't have if you understood, if we understood, that it's ultimately Hakol Bidei Shamayim. My Rebbe, Reb Chaim Volkin, Shlita, the Mashgiach in the Yeshiva at Eretz Yisrael, he told me that many people translate the word emunah, which is the most basic Jewish word, they translate emunah as faith. But he prefers to translate the word emunah as grace. Because if a person has faith, they will go about things in a graceful way. That's the test. That's faith on the ground. And this will bring us back to the Rashi, when the Pasuk says, "Vatikruvun elai kulchem." You came towards me. And Stam, let's ask a question. Once again, we come back. Was it a good idea to send spies? Is it a good idea? Is it kosher? Not kosher? The answer is, it can be kosher. It can be non-kosher. If it's approached from a accompanied why by bitachon, it's wonderful. It's kosher. If it comes as to supplant and push aside bitachon, well, how could that be kosher? So how can you tell? You can tell by how the idea was originally presented to Moshe. Because the Pasuk says, "Vatikruvuna lekulchem." And let's ask a question. How many people does it take to suggest the idea to Moshe? Assuming that if you don't suggest it to Moshe, between him and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they won't think about it. Even if that's your worry. But how many people does it take to float the idea? A handful. I would even say ish echad lashavet. The Pasuk says, no, you all came. What are you going to say? What's person 400,000 going to say that the first 300,000 didn't say? It's the same idea. But when does the crowd come? When there's anxiety. And moreover, says Rashi, but how did you approach? Be'erbuvia, mixed up, tripping over each other. You couldn't get here quick enough. What's going to happen? But if it takes you 30 seconds longer just to give Derech Eretz to people who shouldn't be trampled on, you think you're not going to enter Eretz Canaan in a successful way? Where is that coming from? All of these things, they're not side things. They're symptomatic of the atmosphere that led the Jewish people to say, "Im ein ani li mi li." No one else is taking care of this. It has to be done, and it has to be done now. And if someone's in my way, they need to get out of the way, or else. That's an atmospheric statement, and atmosphere is everything when it comes to the relationship between bitachon and hishtadlus. And that's why when Moshe gives the tochacha, and none of this is really spoken about in Parsha Shelach, because Shelach is, as we would say, just the fact, to say what happened. But Devarim is retrospective. It's about lessons learned, or lessons to be learned, not only for the Jewish people at that time, for all of us. And Moshe is saying, what's happened has happened, but you need to know for the future. Remember how you approached me. Remember how the whole thing started. Kan ha-kelev kavur. That was an ill-fated start to the whole enterprise, and we were looking to recover from that point onwards. It's very interesting to note, as we have in the past, the The nth degree of expectation in this respect is Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef meets criticism for asking the Saramashkim, Kim Zechartani, Pizkartani, and he ended up with another 2 years in jail. It's a long time. And once again, our question is, so should he have done nothing? I mean, one sentence per 10 years seems reasonable by all standards, one could say. Nothing's happened. It's clear that the Saramashkim is here for a reason. And when he asked him to remember him to Paro, which doesn't seem to be a great deal, he's criticized for it very harshly. And he would not be criticized were that not to be considered too much for Yosef. And that means that the level that Yosef is expected to function on, even this is too much. But the question is, but why is it too much? Because it sounds like the alternative is nothing. Is that the correct way for Yosef? Nothing? Even Yaakov does something. Rav Shlomo Kluger says something which is staggering. Indeed, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, Yosef, it was well within his rights, and indeed, once it's within your rights, it's within your obligations. That's how it goes. You can't be neglectful. It would have been neglectful for him not to say anything. So where is the problem? Where is the room for criticism on Yosef's level? The answer is, one of the aspects of the equation here is timing. Timing is everything. Why is that true? Because Yosef sees that the Saramashkim is the shaliach to get him out. In the end, it was true. It just took a lot longer. And therefore, it is entirely in place for him to ask of the Saramashkim, mention me to Paro. The question is, when is it appropriate to ask him? And what's the meaning behind that question? You know for a fact that he is not leaving in any less than 3 days' time. You interpreted his dream. You have on the highest authority. He will be here for 3 days. And if that's true, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, so what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying to Yosef is, so why do you have to ask him now? He's not going anywhere. If you wait another 2 days, he'll still be here. You know that. What are you worried about? You'll forget? You won't forget. How can you forget what else you have to think about? You won't forget. And here is Yosef on the most infinitesimally small degree. It's a fair request, but to ask him now, 2 days early, smacks on a microscopic level of, I have to ask him now. Maybe I'll forget. And that's why Yosef was punished with 2 years in jail. For every day that he brought it forward, reminiscent of this week's parsha, Yom Lashana, Yom Lashana, every day became a year. That's Yosef. But in a sense, the principle is the same. And it's an important lesson for us. And what's interesting is, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Torah doesn't speak openly about this Be'erbuvia at the time. The Torah is looking to move away from that and try and, so to speak, make a go of it. But you will find one vestige. You will find one remez to the jumbled up atmosphere that precipitated the sending of the spies. And that, with no extra ink, is in the order of the names. Rishonim are asking, how to make sense of this order? How are they ordered? By chashivos, by age, certainly not by any other standard that we know. Says Rabbi Yaakov, they're not ordered. They are jumbled up. Here is where the Torah, in its own delicate way, is letting you know there was erbuvia here. And that's how the whole thing started. I think there is perhaps room for one final comment here. There's a famous statement of the Arizal, quoted in his name, that there was some type of antidote for the chet of the Meraglim. And that is the mitzvah of Bikurim. Bikurim is a tikkun for the Meraglim. How? Well, what is Bikurim? Bikurim, you bring the first fruits. However, as we know, it is specifically the seven fruits, Shenishtabcha Bahem Eretz Yisrael. There's only Bikurim from those fruits. And the reason why, says the Arizal, is because we are looking to magnify and amplify the attention given to the Shvach of Eretz Yisrael, that is the Tikkun for the Meraglim. There is a classic comment that is often quoted as a follow-up to this statement of the Arizal from the great Rav Menachem Zember, Hashem Yikom Domo, killed in the Warsaw Ghetto. And the Mishnah in Bikurim talks about how do you identify, how do you remember which were the first fruits? They probably all look the same by the time they ripened. The Mishnah says that you go down at Yerod Lasada, you take a gemi, or you take a chut, and it says the Mishnah, if he sees te'ena shebichra, rimon shebicher, anovim shebichra, if you see a fig that's ripened, or if you see a pomegranate that's ripened, or grapes that ripened, you tie it around. And then you know, and then it will stay there, and that's your bikur when the whole thing ripens. So the Menachem Zember, it's very interesting. We know that the mitzvah bikurim applies to all seven species. That said, the Mishnah, when it wanted to illustrate how you identify and mark off the first of the fruits, gave three examples. Not one, not seven, but three. What is unique about these three fruits that they made it into the Mishnahs? They are the archetypical Bikurim fruits, says Rabbi Nachum Zember. According to the Arizal, we understand. Because the Arizal says that mitzvah of Bikurim comes as a tikkun for the chet of the Meraglim, so generally it applies to all of the seven mitzvahs shenishtabchem Eretz Yisrael. But there were three fruits that were particularly abused in the parsha of the Meraglim. They're the ones that they took back in order to say, look at this land, we don't want to go in here. Eshkol anovim, min harimonim, min hatehenim. That's why they get an honorary reference in the Mishnah. Now, what's interesting, I think, is how is it that the Mishnah of Bikurim, of course, to phrase things delicately here, but becomes the vehicle to be metaken the chet of the Meraglim? What I mean to say is, it sounds like the two are only casually related. You're bringing Bikurim in order to recognize that your crop comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but that's what Bikurim is about. That would be true even if there was never such thing as the Meraglim. And the Meraglim happened to speak ill of Eretz Yisrael. That's also true. And somehow the two come together, but they don't seem to be chemically connected. They just seem to be geographically juxtaposed. How is it that Bikurim is the way to bring out the Shvach of Eretz Yisrael? But I think the answer is, when we appreciate what caused the Bnei Yisrael to speak ill of Eretz Yisrael, they had no anti-Eretz Yisrael sentiment per se. It's because they felt they couldn't live there. They had no choice but to speak ill of the land. If you don't rate your chances of living there, you're going to portray it as a bad place. But why did they not rate their chances of living there? Because they'd moved away from the trust that's necessary for the land, for the people entering Eretz Canaan. If you don't trust HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take you in there, you look at those 31 kings and their armies, they look formidable. And therefore, if you enter the land and reconnoiter without bitachon, you're going to come back and say bad things about Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, the vehicle for re-establishing the Shvach of Eretz Yisrael is the mitzvah Bikurim, which is based on bitachon. It's a person saying, as much as I work in the field through the course of the year, but the first thing that I take from the tree goes to the Beis HaMikdash because I need to remember where it comes from. With all of my hishtadlus, it would not have happened without the bracha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore that mitzvah, which is to re-entrench a person's awareness of how the two go together, of his hishtadlus together with his bitachon, is what allows for the atmosphere of reconnecting with the Shvach of Eretz Yisrael. And that, I believe, is a further aspect of what the Arizal is referring to. We'll leave it over there for this evening.